From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away, on vacation. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this week we were struck by what seems to be unprecedented unanimity in Hollywood over what America wants. For years we've heard about our aching need for more family-friendly programming, and now we've got it in spades. The In-Laws, Life with Bonnie, What I Like About You, shows about going back to high school and remakes of old sitcoms like Family Affair, seems like most networks are just trying to create a safe place where families can nest together. James Poniewozik writes about television for Time magazine, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks a lot.
So what do you think about all this nostalgia fare?
I think that the networks have a sense, or at least had last fall when these shows were conceived, that Americans long to sort of vicariously return to simpler times, if one can actually call the Cold War, when we feared imminent death by nuclear annihilation, a simpler time. Last fall, for instance, we saw the reunion special for the Carol Burnett Show surprisingly draw 30 million viewers, and a lot of people attributed that and the success of similar reunion specials last season to the notion that people wanted to return to the past. I think that's part of the reason that a show like American Dreams made the schedule.
5, 4, 3, 2...
Oh, hey! Don't turn it off! Hi, Mrs. Fryer.
Cue announcer.
Welcome to American Bandstand. Now, here's your host, Dick Clark.
Now, every year we check out the TV guide for trends in the new season's programming. This year, there actually is a bona fide trend, an enormous unanimity among the networks to go for the same slice of the audience, that slice that wants, quote-unquote, family-friendly programming.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a few different factors behind that, not just September 11th. I think there is also a sense on the part of the networks that when in recent years they have tried to go edgier and more daring, it has turned around and bitten them, places where they don't want to be bitten.
Let's talk about a new show on ABC starring John Ritter called 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which is pretty self-explanatory. Now, this program was developed with funding from the Family Friendly Programming Forum, which is a group of advertisers that decided they wanted to have more influence on the programs that they were advertising around, and they produced the very successful Gilmore Girls. So this is another effort. How do you rate John Ritter's chances?
You know, I think the show has a fairly good chance, if for no other reason than network programming has been kind of light on domestic sitcoms, and people are familiar with John Ritter and like him. It's one of the most old sitcom formats on television. Beleaguered dad is trying to figure out what these crazy kids are about nowadays.
I think you missed the word under in underwear because I can see your bra and that slingshot you're wearing under your pants.
It's a thong.
It's floss.
We're the thong generation.
Well, maybe that's why your generation is so angry. You're always walking around with a wedgie.
A lot of critics, myself included, tend to be a little suspicious of any programming that people label quote-unquote family because we worry, and often our worries are well-founded, that it means defanged, bland, lowest common denominator pablum.
You say you tend to be suspicious of anything called family programming, and it turns out that ABC is pretty shy of using the phrase, too. They prefer to use the euphemistic and rather ambiguous happy hour instead.
Right. ABC's come out with this branding notion that from 8 to 9 o'clock on Monday through Friday, they'll have a block of programming for all age groups. And I sort of think the term happy hour is, you know, ironic because it's TV as slightly more healthful version of coming home and forgetting your problems with a fifth of vodka.
What did you mean when you wrote, if we are really backtracking culturally out of anxiety, that's not necessarily something to be proud of?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think that if people really do want to lose themselves in the past and, you know, not see shows that take chances and break new ground, I think it's kind of sad. I think we will have lost something because that really seems to be what a depressed society that sees its better days behind it does. frankly, I think that the network sense that the viewers want to turn back time is really a product of a national zeitgeist that's several months old. But, you know, I think what one has to remember is that when Americans were eating up nostalgic programming in November, around the time the Carol Burnett special aired, for instance, that was really at the height of American fear and anxiety after September 11th. That was when people were still, you know, opening their mail with latex gloves for fear of anthrax. And in the intervening time, we've seen The Bachelor, for instance, and The Osbournes, which are not strictly feel-good, touchy-feely, nostalgic programs, but shows that do push the envelope.
I don't know if this question's going to make it to air, but I can't resist using the S word just once. Do you think Sopranos falls into this nostalgia category, or is it a category all by itself?
I think that The Sopranos is really more an example of the many ways in which pop culture hasn't changed. The idea was that after September 11th, we would want to see softer-edged programming that brought us all together and that didn't look at characters that were morally ambiguous and so forth. And at least the numbers for the debut of The Sopranos have proved that wrong.
Yeah, and they did deal with September 11th.
There is, of course, that very funny scene where Tony is sitting with one of his henchmen at a bar.
It says that Quasimodo predicted it all.
And I'm sure a year ago, a lot of us would have said, well, you could never joke about September 11th that way, even obliquely. And turns out you can, because that's one of the ways that we deal with any kind of tragedy.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
James Poniewozik writes about TV for Time Magazine. As television unloads its fall schedule, the National Association of Broadcasters reconsiders some conventional wisdom about radio. Radio owners and radio executives cheered the 1996 Telecommunications Act because they believed that deregulation would be a financial windfall both for the small owners who would sell out and the conglomerates that would buy in. 6 years since the beginning of radio's consolidation, radio employees and radio owners have less to cheer about. This past week, the NAB staged its annual radio convention in Seattle, and Todd Spencer was there to gauge the state of radio in the age of deregulation.
In the crowded halls of the Washington State Convention and Trade Center, radio group executives, general managers, and sales directors talked about the general state of the economy and paused to breathe a sigh of relief about satellite radio, which doesn't seem as scary now as it once did. Also, they complained about consolidation. Not consolidation in the radio industry, but in the ad industry, which places broadcasters at the pointed end of the consolidation stick. Before consolidation, radio accounted for 7 cents out of every dollar spent on advertising in America. 6 years later, it's still only 7%. Doug Abernathy is the director of sales for Cox Radio Houston.
Everyone thought with consolidation, you know, the advertising dollars that were going to go to radio would be 10%. Well, that hasn't been the case. We're just still fighting over the available dollars in there.
One of the reasons why consolidation hasn't raised revenue share is big radio's struggle to get its hands around cluster selling. A cluster sale is when a company that owns several stations in a market offers deals for advertising on many stations at once. According to Jim Boyle, the radio industry analyst for Wachovia Securities, the problem with cluster sales is that clients might not want to pay for all the stations in a market.
When you try to do a cluster package, there is resistance on the part of the advertiser to have lesser performing stations crammed down their throat.
Which is what Doug Abernathy found in Houston. Currently, Abernathy has a dozen cluster deals. 3 years ago, he had 50. But while clusters haven't generated huge profits, costs have been cut. Doug Abernathy.
The greatest benefit of consolidation is to the bottom line. There's cost reductions with all being in one location, the sharing of a business department, the sharing of a traffic department, the sharing of sales assistants has eliminated a great deal of expense.
According to John Nichols and Robert W. McChesney, authors of the book It's the Media, Stupid, 10,000 radio-related jobs have been lost since 1996 when the deregulation bill was signed. John Sandifer is the executive director of the Seattle local of the radio union, AFTRA.
More and more radio stations have been able to broadcast without great numbers of staff. Those who do not have a live news presence don't have the need to hire news reporters or editors or writers. They may not need a disc jockey because they're only punching a tape and playing it. In Seattle, anyway, we have found that while we once represented 10 stations, we now represent 4.
Industry analyst Jim Boyle says that too much is being made of cost-cutting as a financial boon for big radio.
Cost-cutting is a one-time event, and probably 80% of radio's growth since 1996 has not been cost-cutting, hasn't even been selling more inventory. It's been the ability to raise rates, because radio was always extremely cheap back in the 60s and 70s when newspapers and mom and pops owned most of the business and rarely raised rates above the rate of inflation. So it's raising rates. It's not cutting costs.
Despite recent stock fluctuations, Wall Street has become enamored with radio's potential, according to Boyle. The romance, though, has had its effect on executives at publicly traded radio companies who now find themselves under pressure to meet quarterly estimates. But Doug Abernathy says what big radio needs most is patience. Consolidation has not delivered on some promises, but he believes it's still early.
You got to take a look at this model. I mean, since 1996 to 2002, I mean, we're talking, you know, 6 years. Radio's been selling advertising for 82 years. So, you know, for almost 70 years, we were just beating the living daylights out of each other as radio stations because we weren't big enough to tackle other mediums. The true opportunity is now to go after other mediums where we are bigger than they are.
Abernathy might just get his wish. On the opening day of the NAB convention, the Federal Communications Commission announced in Washington that it would be looking into the idea of further radio deregulation. In the announcement, FCC Chairman Michael Powell called the ownership limits that still remain anachronistic. For the corporate officers and Wall Street analysts attending the NAB convention, it was music to the ears. For On the Media, I'm Todd Spencer.
Coming up, incorrigible American local news, desperate Argentine reality TV, and new voices from an old war. This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The reality television era started with an innocuous program on Dutch TV in the summer of 2000. That show was Big Brother, and it ignited a trend that quickly spread through Europe and the United States, and through the Southern Hemisphere. Because shows like American Idol and Survivor use non-professional actors, they're cheap and easy to produce, so they're perfect for economic downtimes, perfect for places like Argentina. Peter Hudson is a correspondent for Newsweek and The Economist. We called him in Buenos Aires, and he told us reality TV there is just like ours, and then some.
Reality fever has taken on here as much as anywhere else. We've had versions of Survivor. We've had versions of Big Brother. We've had a show called The Bar, which was a number of ordinary people running a bar in Buenos Aires and gradually getting eliminated in the same way as in Big Brother.
It's not that they lose $1 million. They just miss the next round.
That's right. They missed the chance to pick up a cash prize at the end of the program. Of course, this being Argentina, the prize was paid in municipal bonds rather than in currency.
Which brings us to the show Human Resources. I mean, this is a show that takes the genre to the next level. Can you describe how it works?
It's basically a competition to win a job. Unemployment in Argentina is running at over 20%. There's a lot of people who are desperate for employment. And so one of the leading channels here, Canal 13, has set up this program, Human Resources. Two contestants come on and talk about their lives, talk about what they were working in before they became unemployed. And at the end of the program, one of them is awarded a job.
The format of Human Resources, which really seems to weigh sob stories against each other rather than talent, reminds me a little bit of a game show of sorts that there was when I was a very little girl called Queen for a Day, where a bunch of unfortunates would talk about
their lives, and invariably one or several of them would cry, and the audience would vote, and the winner would win, you know, new kitchen appliances or something
that,
like that.
It sounds very similar. I've not seen that show, but the idea is very much the same. If people are not competing for a job, they're competing for a cash prize. The common denominator, I think, in all of these is desperation.
Now, there's another program that seems unique at this point to Argentina. It's called The People's Candidate. This strikes me as yet a whole new advance.
That's right. Argentine viewers are going to get a chance later on this year to vote between a number of contestants. And the idea is that the eventual winner will go on and run for election to the Congress for Buenos Aires and stands a reasonable chance of getting elected purely on the basis of all the free airtime that they're going to get during the course of the program.
How can a TV show decide who goes on the ballot? Have they created their own TV party line?
They have indeed created their own political party. In order to set up a party here, you basically need a few hundred votes. With the number of people who've applied to the program, all of those obviously have to sign up to register the party. With those, they have a good start.
Do you know what the name of the party is?
The name of the party is the Party of the People.
Good enough. It's hard to imagine the disillusion that the Argentinians must be feeling towards their own political system to want to find a congressional candidate using a TV show. You live in Buenos Aires. As far as you can tell, is the situation really that dire?
Certainly, people are very disillusioned with their politicians, and I think the TV channel has obviously seen a chance to tap into that. The TV channel obviously wants to present this as a sort of noble enterprises. The TV channel argues that it's giving people another avenue to pick a candidate. The political parties here are very discredited, and they tend to have a monopoly over who gets elected a candidate. The political parties have so much power and so much financing behind them that if you're selected as a candidate for one of the big parties, then you more or less are guaranteed to get elected.
But if you can fix elections, Peter, can't you also fix a TV show?
I suppose they could, yes. I mean, that's entirely possible. But obviously, one assumes that the TV channel's interest is less in electing a candidate. Obviously, whoever gets elected will just be one congressional deputy in amongst hundreds. The TV channel's interest is obviously more in gaining ratings.
You know, at the height of the reality TV boom here, we were inundated with media watchers decrying the coarsening of the culture. Are there similar voices in Argentina?
I think there's a lot of people, for instance, with the People's Candidate, there's a number of people who've come forward and said that they feel, in my opinion, quite rightly, that the show is cheapening the political process, that it's not really the role of TV stations to be trying to fix Argentine democracy. They should report on what's happening. They should investigate, but they shouldn't be trying to run candidates in elections. In general, though, the state of Argentine TV is so poor that there's very much a feeling that anything goes.
Okay. Peter Hudson, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Peter Hudson is a correspondent for Newsweek and The Economist. He's based in Buenos Aires. TV broadcaster Carol Marine is known for her work on 60 Minutes 2 and for her tenure as one of Chicago's most prominent newscasters, but she gained attention with two decisions. One was to quit a local newscast, which hired Jerry Springer as a commentator. The second was mounting a 10 p.m. newscast that tried to buck the trend of sensational local news. It didn't work, or at least didn't get good ratings, which means the same thing in the world of network television. Last week, Marine hosted a PBS special called Endgame, Ethics and Values in America, and we wanted to ask her about some of her own experiences with professional ethics. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So when you mounted the WBBM newscast, did you feel that you were behaving more ethically than the If It Bleeds, It Leads newscasts?
No. The truth is that I don't think tabloid news is necessarily unethical. It really sort of is what it is. It bleeds, it leads. You know it when you see it. And it's a choice that broadcasters make about how they want to format their newscast. I didn't think that what we did at BBM was necessarily more ethical. It was more in keeping with my view of what news is. I'm a big believer in hard news, no-frills, straightforward investigative journalism. There's no question about that. In local news, one of the big plagues is that it's become generic. It's become dumbed down. It's become so homogenized that every newscast has to end with a water-skiing squirrel. Those are not unethical choices. I think they're bad choices, but I see a distinction.
Why are they bad?
For me, they're bad because they assume that there's a formula, and I don't think there always is a formula. What we see in audiences and the way, as your intro suggested, some people judge success is by the ratings, is that more and more people aren't watching local news, and they're not watching network news. So the competition between the number one, two, and three local stations in a market is still from dwindling pieces of the pie, where before at 10 o'clock or at 11 o'clock at night, 60 to 70% of the audience available was watching local news. Now some markets, big markets, are lucky if 20, 25% are watching local news. People are simply clicking it off because it isn't relevant to them. It isn't interesting because they feel like they see the same thing wherever they go. It's wallpaper.
Do you think that your local news experiment advanced or set back the cause of getting better quality newscasts anywhere else?
You know, I remain to this moment proud that we tried and proud of what we did. And I don't know if it advanced or set it back, but it certainly generated some discussion. And so from my narrow vantage point of having been there and done that with great people, for us, though we wished it had continued, it was a successful venture.
What do you think of the New York Times take on it? It said in reference to your newscast, "It could be taken as a reaffirmation that a serious format cannot succeed, that people need to be drawn in through celebrity gossip and miracle diets introduced by bubbly anchormen and anchorwomen."
I don't believe that. You know, it comes, I mean, I love the New York Times as a newspaper, but its disdain for television sometimes disturbs me. You know, I think that there is a market out there for it, but like everything else, it has to develop. And viewers have to believe that something will last longer than a season, than a 13-week renewable. The things that really endure are the things that everyone thought was going to fail for the first 5 years they were on the air until they picked up some loyal following, and that includes 60 Minutes.
That's certainly been the complaint in entertainment TV, that they just don't let shows develop an audience. They don't let new magazines develop an audience. I think it took Sports Illustrated more than a decade to actually break even. But the need for short-term reward makes those long-term successes that require developing an audience impossible.
But if we see examples where patience actually pays off, I mean, it certainly did for CBS with 60 Minutes. It's certainly done so in other venues. If we can see again and again that taking some time and investing some time delivers a profit, maybe not today and tomorrow, but down the road and in a big way, why isn't that something to emulate? I ask myself and you.
All right. Carol Marine, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Last week, journalist Carol Marine hosted a PBS special called Endgame, Ethics and Values in America. Women are such a presence in war reporting now, it's hard to remember a time when they weren't. Of course, there were a few exceptional women, even in the earliest days. Take Martha Gellhorn, who began her reporting career in the 1930s during the Spanish Civil War and soldiered on through the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989. When the Bosnian War broke out, she finally conceded she was too old to go. "You have to be nimble," she said. During the Vietnam War, reporters had unprecedented access to the battlefield, even women reporters, but they were rare, especially at the beginning. Recently, nine of that select group published a book called War Torn, Stories of War from the Women Reporters Who Covered Vietnam. I spoke to three of them. Tell me how game shows fit into your arrival into Vietnam.
Well, I went on a quiz show called Password to win $500, and I bought a one-way ticket at that time.
Jūrate Kazikas was born in Vilnius during World War II. Her family fled the war to a refugee camp and then finally to America. Her parents could not understand their daughter's obsession with Vietnam. She quit her nice job as a library researcher for Look magazine.
My mother said to me, she said, "My whole life, our whole life has been to keep you from never having to experience a war. But it really was our war. Like any journalist who went over there, I wanted to see for myself."
She was 24. She thought she was immortal. She stood up in the midst of battle to take pictures, and she went to Khe San, the jungle to the north near the demilitarized zone, a place of many battles, but few reporters.
I was only there 24 hours before I was wounded, mercifully, not seriously. it was a little humiliating to have shrapnel in my rear end.
And shrapnel in your face.
Yes, but fortunately the only plastic surgeon in all of the northern part of Vietnam was on duty that day, and he said, if you were a Marine, I would just take a Brillo pad and just scrub all that stuff out of your face. But he worked on me for about an hour, taking out every little piece of shrapnel.
In the book, Kazikas asked herself why she went out on so many patrols with the infantry. Did I really want to be a soldier? Maybe what I really wanted was to experience what another writer called the terrible ecstasy of war and its horrific seduction. She recalls that one colonel commented after hearing she was hit, well, she got what she was looking for. Kate Webb was just starting out as a journalist in Australia when she felt the pull of the war.
I couldn't understand the war. And there were arguments in pubs. I was in Sydney then, and the boys who were marching out were getting paint thrown at them.
Like Kazikas, Webb bought a one-way ticket. When she got off the plane in Saigon in March of 1967 and set off to find a job, she was 23. Eventually, she found her way to UPI and became the Cambodian bureau chief when her predecessor was killed. She covered the Tet Offensive, broke the story over strong objections in Washington of Cambodian leader Lon Nol's disabling stroke. She saw many friends die. She was tough on reporters who took needless risks. Then she was taken captive by North Vietnamese troops on the south coast of Cambodia.
It's one of those things that's fascinating if you live to tell it. I was able to see how the other side operated, in a limited way, of course. When you're tied up and marching all night, you don't see much.
How about the experience itself? What it was like simply to live as a prisoner of war?
Physically, it was very tough. I lost 10 kilos in 3 weeks. Walking all night on bare feet, that's 12 hours a night, next to no food. You have to keep sort of urging yourself on as if you're a small child. You talk to yourself and say, keep going.
Journalists like Kate Webb and Yurate Kazikas paved the way for people like Laura Palmer, who came to the war just as it was ending. She wasn't driven by a passion for journalism.
I literally hitchhiked to Vietnam.
Actually, she was hitchhiking back to Berkeley in summer school. A car stopped. She eventually hooked up with the driver, a pediatrician. He went to Vietnam. She followed him.
Haven't you ever done dumb things for love? Come on, Brooke, tell us. You know, it was 3 a.m. He was in Morocco. The phone rang. I picked it up. He said, I got a job offer. Vietnam, 6 months. Do you want to go? I said, sure.
Neither Palmer, nor Kazikas, nor Webb, for that matter, had had any experience covering a war when they arrived in Vietnam. But when Palmer landed in 1972, women reporters had already proved themselves. And when the pediatrician left and Palmer began looking for work, it was women back home who did the heavy lifting. Women reporters at the New York Times had launched a major sex discrimination suit just about the time Palmer was prospecting for a job at ABC.
Major media organizations knew they needed women on the air. I was, as the bureau chief at ABC News in Saigon, said to me on my first day at work, he sat me down beside him. I was all of 22 years old, and he looked at me and said, well, of all the applicants, you were the least qualified. And that was absolutely true.
For Palmer, being female was by now an advantage in Vietnam. Some sources were more inclined to open up to a woman, but there were drawbacks. For instance, she was offered a tour and lunch by General Minh, the commander in charge of the Saigon region. She thought they would eat at HQ, but a table was set in his trailer with a big double bed.
And I thought, oh my God, what have I walked into? He asked me if I liked music. I said, yes, I liked the Rolling Stones, and he liked the Carpenters. And then he looked at me with all earnestness and said to me, Miss Laura, would you go-go for me?
She said no.
What I really wanted to say was, you son of a bitch. People are dying under your command. This was one of the top 5 generals in Vietnam. And you're having lunch with me, giving me a fake Cartier lighter, and asking me to go-go for you? And I thought, there is no way, if there's this much corruption at the top, that they will ever win the war.
She did see the general again, right after the evacuation of Saigon. She sat with him briefly on an aircraft carrier sailing to the Philippines.
He looked very small and very quiet, and he was chain-smoking Salems and drinking Kool-Aid, and I don't know, we ended up talking about Elton John, and it just was one of those strange, surreal moments that happen so often in Vietnam or because of Vietnam.
Martha Gellhorn, that crusty war veteran, wrote that of all wars, I hated Vietnam the most because I felt personally responsible. I'm talking about what was done in South Vietnam to the people whom we supposedly had come to save. Napalmed children, destroyed villages. My complete horror remains with me as a source of grief and anger and shame that surpasses all others. There are 9 compelling, very different stories in War-Torn, a melange of battlefields and love affairs, political commentary and personal exploration. Ultimately, War-Torn is less a book about women than a book about the war.
This was a war like no other for everybody to get that close to the fighting. Nobody ever is numb to it. There were many people who had nervous breakdowns. There were several suicides among male reporters. It took its toll. It really did.
Yurate Kazikas, wounded in Khe Sanh, is a writer who has co-authored several books on women's history. Laura Palmer, who hitchhiked to Vietnam, is now an independent TV producer who works primarily for ABC's Nightline. Kate Webb, taken prisoner in Cambodia, worked most recently for Agence France-Presse in Southeast Asia until 2001 when she retired from journalism. Next up, directors who don't want editing to fall into the wrong hands, and a musician who wanted it in everybody's hands, Glenn Gould. This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Thanks to the internet, you can get almost anything by mail order these days, and in December, you'll be able to order first-run independent films, like the Spanish hit El Bola. El Bola will be the first film sent to members of Film Movement, a new indie DVD of the Month club created by Lawrence Maestrich, founder of the independent production company Shooting Gallery. He helped bring New York's independent film industry to prominence with films like Sling Blade and You Can Count on Me. Now he wants to revolutionize the distribution of indie films by giving Film Movement members the chance to see previously unreleased indies in the comfort of their own homes or in limited theatrical runs. Lawrence Maestrich joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you think that the independent film industry needs a DVD of the Month Club?
Well, it's actually a little bit more than a DVD of the Month Club. Really, our concept is to create national access to independent film or specialized film. So if it's opening in Manhattan, it's also opening in Saddle River, New Jersey, and Augusta, Georgia, and Des Moines, Iowa. It's just opening in your living room.
You've only had a couple of weeks to start amassing subscribers. Who are they? Where are they?
Well, that's the really interesting thing. They are from all over. Wappingers Falls, Freehold, New Jersey, South Bend, Indiana. And it's been really heartening because that's what I had hoped. I had hoped that it wasn't going to be like a New York thing. You know, in a town like a Ridgewood, New Jersey, that has 25, 30,000 people, I know theatrically there isn't a business for this because you need all 25 or 30,000 people to go opening weekend just to break even. But I know there's 1,000. I know there's 500, and that makes perfect sense for us.
Now, I know you hate the Book of the Month Club analogy, but do you think it's possible that the film movement can do for independent films what the Book of the Month Club does for books? Do you think you have the potential to be not only a profitable venture, but actually a launching pad for indie hits?
You know, I don't mind the Book of the Month analogy. The Book of the Month Club got people to read and varied things, whether it was Oprah's book club or some of the more specialized book clubs. I want people to watch different kinds of movies. I don't think America is stupid. I'd love if kids, you know, out in the farm somewhere are seeing these films and subscribing and then decide to become filmmakers and bring a Midwestern point of view to Sundance or a Southern point of view or a different view of Manhattan than we've seen 850 times. I would love if that happened.
Give me an idea about the distribution of indie films now. It is easier than it used to be, right?
I don't believe so. I think it's markedly harder. I think there's going to be a big sort of sea change in the independent film industry because of the cost of marketing. Take a film like In the Bedroom. Sissy Spacek and that cast can go on Letterman, can go on Leno, can get on Rosie. But is David Letterman going to book the woman from Big Fat Greek Wedding pre being a hit? Of course not. Once it hits, then she gets on, but it happened after the fact. For most films who don't have that, they are faced with a distributor going, all right, for me to really do anything properly in the U.S., I have to spend $2 to $5 million. For me to spend $2 to $5 million, I need to think that I'm going to get 10 to 20 out of the box office back, because that's what's going to make my ancillaries more valuable to me, ancillaries being video, pay cable, all of that other stuff. So things start to get put in these boxes. Is there a hook? Blair Witch hook, a star hook, a comedic hook, and things like Big Fat Greek Wedding, frankly, come out of nowhere. Everybody passed on that movie. The producers paid the distributor to do it. Memento, same thing. The financiers, the last 2 years, the two biggest hits, the producers put up the money to release those films.
Does that mean that the indie revolution that we've been hearing so much about ever since Sundance took off is still pretty much a pipe dream?
I think if you create solutions to the distribution dilemma, it's not a pipe dream. There's still a lot of talented people making a lot of really good works, and they're finding homes at film festivals and finding homes at event places like the Asia Society and BAM and outlets like that, but they're not finding a home in broad traditional distribution. What we're trying to say is, we'll go to Sundance for you, we'll go to Cannes for you, and we'll pick the best 12 films of the year, and we'll curate for you, like a film festival does, and you can watch it at your leisure.
Lawrence Maestrich is the CEO of the Film Movement and founder of the production company Shooting Gallery. If you're interested in the film movement, you can find it at www.thefilmmovement.com. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Digital technology has been a boon to filmmakers, but as the software's gotten cheaper, it's become something of a nightmare. Because companies like MovieMask now sell devices that can allow viewers of various sensibilities to watch any version of a particular film they wish. One with the violence, say, but with the sex masked, or with the sex and the violence, but the curse words blanked out. One of these days, you could sit home and watch The Godfather with the kids, secure in the knowledge that they won't be seeing Sonny with the bridesmaid up against the door. Filmmakers, though often willing to edit their own movies for TV or airplanes, are predictably unhappy with strangers taking on the task. In fact, Martha Coolidge, a director herself and head of the Directors Guild, says this is one issue the entire film community can agree on. She joins me now. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Now, defenders of the technology that we're talking about here liken it to getting some good advice from someone who's screened the movie before you and can tell you when to block the screen and what to skip. Would you be against it if it weren't actually technology, but just a list of instructions blocking some scenes because of nudity and skipping certain scenes or even individual frames to excise bad language or blasphemies?
But Brooke, wouldn't you have a problem if someone was listening to your program and gave instructions as to how to fast forward to skip over the part that you'd spent the entire interview working up to? What you're talking about is someone else who did not make the movie, who does not know the material as intimately as the filmmakers and the copyright holders do, making arbitrary decisions as to what they do and do not like for the viewer. The viewer never sees the material.
There's always going to be a disparity between what the directors intend to give the audience and how the audience uses the films that are given to them. It seems as if you're trying to control the uncontrollable, how your films are perceived or even used.
I think that it has to do with your creation and your property. We are a country based on protection of property. Directors make thousands and thousands and thousands of decisions regarding every aspect of a movie. And the idea that certain movies are simply inappropriate for certain age groups or certain people is accurate. Steven Spielberg made E.T. That is appropriate for children. And he made Saving Private Ryan, which he said was not. The whole point of the movie was to be groundbreaking in its gritty depiction of war and reality. And the idea of someone else taking that movie, not Steven Spielberg, someone else taking that movie and chopping it up so that it's appropriate for children when it was never, never, never intended for children. And frankly, in my opinion, no matter how much you take out of the movie, the subject matter is not appropriate for children.
what we're talking about here is technology that gives people greater choice in tailoring entertainment. And that is what entertainment is tending toward. And one benefit that you can presumably draw from all of this is that the people who wouldn't want to see a movie with a nude scene in it would go and see it if they had the opportunity to blank that nude scene out. Does the potential for a larger audience give you any satisfaction?
Well, Brooke, you can look at it the other way. Imagine how many movies would have an increased audience if you put nude scenes in. And would you defend that, too? Would you think that nude scenes could be provided on this nude technology, which can provide it? It can dress Kate Winslet in the Titanic. Believe me, it can undress people in other movies. It is still an arbitrary decision made by someone based on what they believe. There are senseless alterations. There's the lightsaber version of Princess Bride. Whom does that benefit? Who was offended by the swords? Is this not just the simple fact that it can be done? Therefore, let's do it.
Well, Martha Coolidge, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for dealing with the issue.
Martha Coolidge is the president of the Directors Guild of America. While directors recoil at the idea of strangers meddling with their work, one star musician shouted, "Bring it on!" 70 years after his birth and nearly 20 years after his death, pianist Glenn Gould remains perhaps the most controversial performer in 20th century classical music. Though performer is a label appropriate for only half of Gould's creative life, at the age of 31 and already internationally famous, he renounced the concert stage and declared that he would henceforth express himself solely through the media. He spent the last 20 years of his life defending and extolling the creative potential of the media, in between issuing recordings that were praised, savaged, and top sellers. On the Media's senior producer, Arun Roth, climbed down from his ivory tower to deliver this report.
If we want to be glib, we can reduce Glenn Gould's media prophecy to this. The concert is dead. Long live recording. Of course, the concert isn't dead. Classical ticket sales are doing better than ever. But it's also true that media have forever changed our experience of music. Tim Pade is a music critic for The Washington Post and the editor of the Glenn Gould Reader.
To give you an example, when the Metropolitan Opera put on Strauss's Elektra in 1981 with Birgit Nielsen, and they telecast it over PBS, it's estimated that more men, women, and children saw and heard the work that night than the sum total of all audiences that had encountered Elektra since its premiere in 1909. Now, that's one single night. That's saying quite a lot.
Gould even found possibilities in the limitations of technology. As a child listening to Arthur Schnabel playing Beethoven concertos, Gould enjoyed the mandatory breaks every 4 minutes to flip the 78s. Breaking the music down into these segments helped him understand Beethoven's structures. Gould believed the concert hall bred bad habits in even the best musicians. In a 1968 interview, he described how he came to put exaggerated phrases in a Bach partita.
And the reason that they got into it was that I had to play it in very large halls, which weren't set up with Bach in mind, certainly, and to try to project it to that man up there in the top balcony. And as I did that, I gradually picked up all kinds of what I suppose Sir Tyrone Guthrie would call bits of business, you know? And I added this hairpin and that hairpin to a phrase that didn't demand it, didn't need it, and that ultimately destroyed the fabric of the music.
So Gould favored an intimate acoustic in his recordings. Andrew Quint is the classical music editor for The Absolute Sound.
Gould's recordings were all made for Columbia and CBS in studios, or in studio-like environments, like the little department store auditorium that he utilized for all those years in Toronto, and not in concert halls. This, of course, gave him a great deal of control over the finished product, but it also allowed him to reject sonically the concert hall experience. He didn't want the music to have any kind of acoustic halo or to sound overly reverberant. The sound on his records is very close up and immediate. I think with these recordings, the listener at home is invited to join him in what's a very intensely personal experience, an exploration of the music at hand, and Gould's recordings really pull you in.
the intimacy was crucial. Gould longed for what he called a one-to-one relationship with his listener, something he thought couldn't take place in a crowded concert hall. A large part of Gould's concert aversion came out of his personal hang-ups. He hated traveling, hated playing with unfamiliar orchestras and untested instruments. And while playing before thousands of people, Gould felt as uncomfortable as a Buddhist in the Roman Colosseum.
There's a very curious and almost sadistic lust for blood that overcomes the concert listener. There's a waiting for it to happen, a waiting for the horn to fluff, a waiting for the strings to become ragged, a waiting for the conductor to forget to subdivide, you know? And it's dreadful.
But mostly he objected to the hierarchy of the concert hall, the plight of the guy in the cheap seats who couldn't hear as well. Gould thought that if music gets distorted for that poor fellow in the last row of the balcony, aren't concerts unfair, even immoral? Andrew Quint.
I think there's a democratizing aspect of recordings, to be sure, but this becomes less of an issue when the right kind of music is being played in the right kind of hall.
Even an acoustically perfect performing space wouldn't have been enough for Gould. Part of his moral quest was to deliver as inspired and perfect renderings as possible, and he resented what he called the non-take-two-ness of the concert. Gould threw himself into the production process, the ability to equalize the sound, splice in corrections, and pick from alternate takes. And for this, the perfectionist was loathed by the purists.
They feel that there's a certain amount of cheating involved. Of course there is. Mm-hmm. And they resent the fact that you can, in fact, virtually eliminate error.
He relished what he called discovery in the studio. For instance, one of his more provocative interpretations of Bach was a product of an editing session some weeks after the original recording.
One fugue, the A minor from the first volume of the Volta per Clavier, consisted of two extraordinary takes which were absolutely different in character and which miraculously matched each other, paced each other in tempi. And this is very unusual.
Unless you're especially sensitive to piano technique or listen very closely, it's hard to detect the splices between the turgidly phrased take six and the jaunty take eight. Most of the time, the effect is of a subtle sense of emotional movement. So through an act of inspiration after the actual performance, we get an interpretation that never could have occurred in the concert hall.
I think one can really treat tape as a film director treats his rushes. One can look at it the day after and say, now what have we really got here? What can we do with this? What does this all mean?
Electronic media also gave the listener some creative control, moving closer to that one-to-one relationship that Gould craved. That relationship began with the first volume knob, but what Gould ultimately had in mind is a lot more involved.
I'd love to issue a series of variant performances and let the listener choose what they themselves most like. Let them assemble their own performance. Give them all the component parts, all the component splices, rendered at different tempi with different dynamic inflections, and let them put something together that they really enjoy, make them participant to that degree.
That's a lot to ask from a listener. But Gould thought most media so far had underestimated consumers. He believed in the capacity of people, not just to handle the technology, but to comprehend several ideas at once. If he had a favorite musical form, it was the fugue, a composition that simultaneously makes use of several melodic lines. When he made a radio documentary about the Canadian North, Gould used his interviews the way Bach used tunes.
Well, I did one of 30 days
for another 11 years.
Perhaps they would.
There's no particular reason, it seems to me, why one shouldn't be able to comprehend clearly and concisely two or three simultaneous conversations.
Simply traveled it month after month, year after year. I can't conceive of such a person being really untouched.
Not a surprising sentiment for a guy who could play a five-voice Bach fugue and give a distinct character to each individual line. He may have overestimated his audience a little, but the fact is media consumers engage in this type of fugal multitasking all the time. Like now, maybe you're listening to the radio while flipping through the paper or surfing the net. And even television, the one household medium apt to capture our whole attention, is cluttered with boxes and crawls, and we have the option to follow some or all of them at the same time. In his own time, Gould used the power of media to open new frontiers in old music, but he also predicted, in his quirky take-no-prisoners fashion, the potential of electronic media and its audience to open new frontiers on the full range of art and ideas. For On the Media, I'm Arun Roth.
The 70th anniversary of Glenn Gould's birth is this Wednesday. He said he wasn't going to play the piano past the age of 50, and he died of a stroke just 10 days after that birthday in 1982. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards. And edited by me. We had help from Natasha Kurgankor and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I've had for some few years the idea that radio was being improperly used.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.